This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to another episode of Good Things with me, Dashran Johan. And my guests on today's show are two law students who in September 2020 decided to start an initiative called Women for Refugees to empower illiterate migrant and refugee women to integrate into local communities. I'm, of course, talking about Davina Devarajan and Arisa Jemima Ikram, who are with me on Skype right now. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you?
Good, we're doing good. So glad to be on.
All right, Arisa, perhaps we can start with you. Tell me what exactly is Women for Refugees? What exactly do you guys do?
Well, I think Women for Refugees. Yeah, where do you start? I don't know. I think in the short time that we've operated, Women for Refugees has successfully been able to branch into so many things, you know, and while it was essential for us to do that, to see that our main objective was carried out. And the main objective of WFR was to empower refugee women or women from marginalized communities with skills, being English or digital literacy, starting to introduce more modules on entrepreneurship. Through that we've identified those learning skills as crucial elements to empower women that come from these communities. So I think in a general perspective, that's what WFR can be defined as doing. Although in a more broader sense, WFR has meddled into other industries like medical, like aid, like charity, as much as, you know, we say the opposite. But yeah, it's something that we always have to deal with, because it's unrealistic for any organization to work with a community that is very vulnerable and expect them to prioritize, say, education. So it was as essential for us to prioritize other things like making sure they have food on the table, making sure their children are healthy, just so that they can make education a priority, just so that they can block out time for us to come down and teach, just so that they can focus in their class because they don't have all of these other things on their mind.
I agree with what you're saying. And in a nutshell, I think what we've learned from working in Women for Refugees is that, especially when you're working with vulnerable and marginalized communities, you can go in with a plan, but you're going to find so many challenges and obstacles. And in WFR, that's kind of what we've seen. So we had to pivot several times. Hence why she's talking about, you know, having to take on medical aid and do fundraising, having to come up with food aid as well. And all these little initiatives that we started doing that is a little bit outside the scope we initially planned for. So a lot of pivoting, but super exciting. Very nice to see how much we've grown in the few months that we've been operating.
And WFR is doing quite a bit. So it sounds like a lot of work. Do y'all do this full time? Because I like I mentioned in the introduction earlier, both of you guys are students, and I know Davina is also with Undi 18. So tell me about how do y'all like manage all of this?
Yeah. So the dynamic of us working, I mean, me and Dav, since we go way back, there was a lot of dynamics that we had to establish between us, and in that process of figuring out how we can work as effectively to provide for WFR, considering our own priorities, we had to identify our own strengths. So Davina is incredibly brilliant at internal management, and exactly what she does is at Undi 18 as well. And I'm not so great at that. I'm not a very diplomatic person. Dav knows this. But I work very well with on-ground projects, so directly talking to refugees and then relaying that information so that Dav knows what structure to put in place. And with that, we were able to sort of know how to come in with our own bandwidths. And can I just add that I am not actually a law student. I actually study 50% law, mm-hmm. But I don't. I try not to identify myself as a law student because I can't do law. It is the hardest thing in the world. I don't know how Dav graduates, but this is why we need her, because she graduated with law.
This girl is too humble right now.
Davina, have you seen my law paper? Have you seen it? You haven't, because there isn't one. Do you get it?
So, Davina, you tell me your side of the story then. Arisa said you guys go way back. How did y'all come together to start this initiative? What inspired y'all?
Okay, so when she says we go way back, basically we ended up, so I don't know if you know what Malaysian youth delegation is. So they had speaking engagements, basically. So we went to a few conferences, and that's basically how we met. And I think just throughout our friendship, we've had a lot of intense discussions about all these issues that we were seeing around us that we were quite passionate about. And we had really ambitious goals. Even when it came to the whole refugee crisis, we were thinking we wanted policies put in place. We wanted Malaysia to ratify the 1951 refugee convention. We were very ambitious when we were starting out. And then we realized, okay, yeah, we're way in over our heads. By the time we were really talking about this, we kind of came, because we volunteered and done a lot of work with other organizations in terms of the refugees cause as well. So when we stumbled upon the committee that we're working with now, they were actually the ones that asked for an initiative to empower the women there. And we kind of just looked at it like, this is a wonderful opportunity to just get our feet in the ground and start something. And so that's kind of how we started. Like she said in the beginning, honestly, WFR was just us hitting the ground running, kind of just trying to figure it out as we were going, not really knowing what we were signing up for in the beginning. But then I'm pretty happy to say that, I mean, we figured out a lot of the initial challenges, at least. So I guess I would say that it's more like WFR stumbled on us. That's how I look at it.
Mm. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I think one of the things that I kind of want to add is, when it comes to like NGOs, it's so important for the community to tell us what they want instead of us coming in and assuming what they want and hoping that they would react well with what our service is and our charity. And I think Dav ruled it out pretty well. They stumbled upon us. I think establishing an NGO was probably like my 5-year plan. It was never in the like short-term goal. So me and Dav, when we knew what we had to do, we just sat down and just like, we just had to do it. You know, there's no more planning, there's no more sitting down, and you can plan as much as you want, but you have to leave room for error. And that's what we did, I guess.
Arisa, what exactly, you know, one thing I really liked that Davina brought up is that how, as y'all were, you know, planning all of this, once y'all started, y'all realized that, okay, maybe y'all need to pump the brakes instead in terms of ambition, right? And I think that is something that a lot of us who are maybe on the younger end in this industry, right? Like even as a journalist, you know, when you become a journalist, you think, okay, now I'm going to change the world. You know, I'm going to speak into a mic and suddenly the country is going to become progressive. You know, we have all these big, big ideas, and then you realize that, you know, maybe it's more about pushing the needle 0.1 millimeters at a time, right? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think I actually did a really short speech on burnout and the relation of burnout to activists, and how the generation that we have now is there's so much more. It's so much more easier for them to get into activism, and so there is a direct relation to burnout. But with this whole, there is a very common situation where we come in and we just want to solve the entire situation. I think you said like journalists. I wanted to be a journalist at one point. Dav knows this. I wanted to go to Palestine, call out the Israeli government.
Right.
So it always starts with very big ambitions. And I think that's a step that is very necessary when you want to get into activism. But another step that is also necessary is to identify where you stand as a person. What are your capabilities? If you are a student, what are the privileges that are afforded to you, and how can you leverage that into the service or into the charity that you want to take up? It was so unrealistic for me and Dav to challenge the government for a policy change. And I think it was a conversation between me and Dav and someone else, I'm not sure, where they said there have been NGOs working on policy change in terms of refugees in Malaysia for decades now. What is the difference that you are going to bring in? And we literally had no idea. We just knew that there was a problem, or we vaguely knew that there was a problem and we wanted to solve it. And we only saw policy change as the solution. So I think in one perspective, it was so important for us to widen our horoscope. I mean, even now, you know, we haven't really figured it out. What we know is we're taking it step by step, and we know that even though it may not contribute to like massive changes tomorrow, it'll contribute to the conversation.
I think, like you said, right, a lot of youths today are extremely ambitious. They want to do a lot of things. Us, exactly the same, you know. But I think finding the right opportunity to be able to exercise these kind of ambitions, you either put yourself in that situation or you find the problem that you need to solve. So when I say WFR stumbled upon us, it was that we saw a problem in a very specific community. And I guess we felt very compelled when it came to solving the problems. And like Arisa said, we made a lot of plans in the beginning about how we wanted to be involved in this issue, how we wanted to solve this problem, how we wanted to play our part. It was just too much planning and not enough action. So by the time we were speaking to the community leader at the time in this community, and I think just like at the time, having each other, at least for me, I felt like it was very helpful because it gave us the accountability to be able to act on it when needed. So that's why I felt like it stumbled upon us just as much as we were looking for it.
And how, because a lot of people, right, most people, when they are in their uni days, you know, they're worried about their exams, they're worried about, you know, getting a job and things like that. Where did y'all find the, which is of course, you know, the number one priority for all of us, right? But where do y'all find that extra energy or that passion or the drive? Like, how do you, amidst all your exams and your preparations and your presentations, also feel, I see Arisa laughing, I don't know what that means, but where do you find that drive? What pushed you to do that?
I think on my personal capacity, I think we even have to look beyond passion. We have to look, for example, my situation. I am extremely privileged. Extremely privileged. I have a very supporting family. I do not have to worry about my education because I don't have to, you know, because I understand the materials. I genuinely have an interest in the materials that I'm learning. International politics is a thing that I do in my free time because I understand it. So that is a privilege. I don't have to worry about finance. I don't have to worry about getting a job. So all of these privileges allow me to work on things like this and build it to a point where it's a full-time thing. So I feel like every single person has some passion, has some drive, but they are not afforded the, you know, the luxuries of being able to pursue it. So I think that's on my end. And working with Dav is just another brilliant thing, because, you know, having a brain and then another brain, you know, it's, can you see how my hands connect?
Okay. You are clearly in the maximum Friday mood already.
Can you verbally describe that?
Daph, what about you?
I think, when I look at, I feel like my experiences might be just slightly different. I think what got the ball rolling for me was that I never had it as hard as the refugee community or anything like that. But I think I was exposed enough to be able to see what things can look like when you're not afforded certain opportunities. And I think that kind of got me very interested in the idea of how does especially poverty affect communities. And so growing up, it was something that I looked for. I think I did a lot of very small volunteer stints here and there in terms of kids and poverty when I was younger, and then kind of seeing the effects on that. But then fast forwarding till today, I think what really helped me really get involved in this whole situation was, to be honest, the accountability that I had from Arissa. Because I think that had I only wanted to stand on the sidelines and understand what was happening in this whole with this whole issue, and especially in terms of poverty, I wouldn't have had the guts to kind of just dive into it straight, because I would constantly feel like there's more to learn before I could do something. So having someone who could kind of just say, let's just try this, was very helpful for someone like me, who was more hesitant to just dive in because of the risk that was involved in the beginning. But yeah, I guess I would say, like, I agree with her. It's not entirely passion. Sometimes I think it's a feeling of, it's like a call to duty. I think you start to see what's happening with the people around you, what's happening in the community around you, and then even experiences in your own life, and you realize there is too much happening for you to stay quiet. And you just, sometimes, at least for me, I just needed a bit more of a push to say that something has to be done, and something has to be done now.
I do want to talk to you guys about the refugee community, but we do need to go for a very quick break. I'll be back with more with Davina Devarajan and Arissa Jemima Ikram, the co-founders of Women for Refugees. You're listening to Good Things on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things, a weekly show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. On the show with me today are Davina Devarajan and Arissa Jemima Ikram, the co-founders of Women for Refugees, which is an initiative that aims to empower illiterate migrant and refugee women and, you know, help them integrate back into local communities. Now, let's talk a little bit about the refugee community. Arissa, can you describe what the reality is in Malaysia? Because I think a lot of people don't know, you know, what exactly they go through. What are their daily struggles, right? Especially when it comes to their access to education.
Yeah. So broadly, in terms of education, refugees are not allowed to access education. So we are talking about an entire population, children, who do not have access to education, or they have access, but they do not have the finances to get that kind of education. That's a reality on just on education. In other sectors as well, it's so much more difficult for refugees to get into, to adapt, to live, live. You know, so the reality of refugees in Malaysia, it's been riddled with race and religion as political tools, and those elements are not so far off from the Malaysian reality. Yeah. So one thing that me and Dav always talk about is, when you want to talk about refugees in Malaysia, you have to kind of identify what kind of refugee you're talking about, because the reality is, for an Afghan refugee, it's so much more different for a Rohingyan refugee.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, refugees coming from Palestine, Syria, countries that are situated closer to the Middle East, mm-hmm. And are riddled with war, they may have, or they may face a different treatment. And I'm going to tell you one example. Palestinians are looked at in Malaysia as I think they hold the highest part in the refugee hierarchy. And it's because Palestine holds a very dear place in Islam. And if you see Malaysia, we have a history of humanitarian aid or you know, pushing out humanitarian aid that is more closer to the Muslim cause. We've helped, one of our biggest missions was during the Bosnian War. We even helped Somalis because they all were persecuted because of their religion. So Malaysia has had this history of a sort of responsibility where the government comes in when Muslims around the world are being attacked for their faith. But even that, because of that, it has created a hierarchy. So, for example, Chin refugees in Malaysia, they are not Muslims, but they do not necessarily are afforded the same treatment as a Muslim refugee. But similarly, you also have to look at race. So because Arabs, for example, are much more, I don't want to say it, but it's more complexion. You know, there's whitewashing, there's so many more elements that we can identify as factors to to why the government reacts a certain way to this group of refugees rather than to that group of refugees. There have been scholarships, there have been government-aided campaigns for Palestinians, for Syrians, but never those afforded to the Rohingyans. And even then, taking that a step further, it's because the Rohingyans overpopulate Malaysia. It is a population that we are just unable to control. And it's not because the Malaysian government does not care. It's a mess. The local population, local industries are unable to deal with it because there isn't a policy. You know, local sectors are being overwhelmed because they don't have a framework to deal with refugees. A big example, and an example that I commonly use, is hospitals, because WFR works so closely with hospitals. And even in my own personal capacity, we work with hospitals. And you can't really blame anyone that is working for, you know, discriminating against a refugee, because a refugee without a government policy, how am I supposed to do my job, for example? Because I don't recognize you. My country does not recognize you. But my duty to care and duty to give service is there. So it's conflicting for a nurse, for a doctor.
Devina, when y'all started, one of the things that y'all really focused on, which I believe y'all are still doing right now, is the push to teach these refugees English and Bahasa Malaysia. Why is education, particularly, you know, learning languages like English and Bahasa, important to these refugees?
Well, I mean, very simply also an integration factor, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you come, especially if you're coming to Malaysia and you don't speak the language, actually, no, for any refugees in any new country, if you're going to a new country, you don't speak the language. So it's a severe hindrance to your livelihood, to your ability to live day to day, right? So when we were talking about our initiative, why we added literacy as the first component was because, to be fair, integration was something that we realized needed to happen first, because it's hard to get their buy-in when they don't really understand what we're trying to say. They don't know how to communicate to us what they want. So we did start off with English and occasionally Bahasa Malaysia as well. And we tried to replicate scenarios that might be more common to them. So things like going to the police station, hospitals, everything. And then trying to use that to kind of go on to the next step, which is digital literacy, entrepreneurship type education, all of these things. But I think kind of going back to languages and why that's very important is because even just your right to defend yourself, your right to vocalize what you need. When, like Arisa says, right, one of the things that we work on is also medical aid. Imagine going to the hospital and not being able to communicate what's wrong, not being able to have the doctors or anyone understand what is it that you need, what is happening right now. It's a very scary situation for anyone to be in. And then this often leads to the fact that they have to be reliant on either NGOs or any persons around them. The feeling, I can imagine feeling like that, being in a foreign country, not knowing how to communicate when something is wrong. If I'm not sick and my family member is sick, there's so many things that come into play in such a situation, right? So I guess realizing how important language is was why we wanted to implement that in the first place. But of course, what one thing that at least I've learned personally is that this is not even literacy itself cannot be like a 3-month program,
right?
You know, it's how do we integrate them into even just local slang, because I can teach them perfect English. Sometimes it might not necessarily be helpful as well, you know, if they're speaking to someone who is more accustomed to Bahasa Malaysia, for example, and in certain slang, certain things they might not be able to understand. So it's a process of, okay, how do you integrate them into a community? And that is something that at least I feel like we are still trying to figure out. We're still trying to learn how to vocalize to them and how to implement with them.
And there's also the added layer that, you know, like y'all brought up earlier, Malaysia has not ratified the Refugee Convention. So a lot of times when refugees come to Malaysia, it's more of like a temporary place for them. And what, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong again. I've spoken to a couple of refugees, and they said that, you know, a lot of times they come to Malaysia, but they have dreams to go to US, for example. And this is why learning languages like Bahasa English could also, like English could actually help them, right? When they are planning to migrate or to move to other, you know, international countries, whether it's US or whatever it may be, UK.
I think language, in the sense that how WFR is pushing it, is used more as an empowerment tool, on top of other things that Dav brilliantly mentioned. But even just on the foundation of understanding how language works, there's a certain science to it that it allows you to take control of the conversation, or allow you to make the decision to start a conversation, to pick a fight, for example. Malaysia is essentially a transit country. If you ask any refugee, there is no objective for them to stay here and make a living, because they also understand that there is no policy for them here. But Malaysia, because we do not have a framework, they are not able to pass by and resettle in a smoother transaction. And even just the process of resettlement, to apply for resettlement, it can take 2 to 3 years, or your application could just not be a priority if you are not a single mother, if you are an orphan, they will not ship entire families to another country like the US that will recognize their status, that will recognize their ability to work, that has current organizations to work with them, funded by the government, for example. So yeah, even you know, I don't think WFR has ever looked at teaching English as a resettlement kind of, okay, when they're resettled, then they'll use that English. It's more of, it's incredibly empowering. The reality is, for example, if I meet, or if I send my team to meet a refugee, and that refugee immediately speaks English, the first reaction my team will be, anyone, even in the NGO sector, will be like, oh my God, you're so smart. You know, and that's even that is just like, ugh, it's so icky to even think that way. But that's the reality. Because we understand how English has been, there's even a hierarchy in language.
One thing that I found very fascinating when you guys launched last year was that y'all had this idea that y'all wanted to primarily teach women. Why specifically did y'all choose to try to empower women in the refugee community specifically? Do they go through their own individual set of challenges that perhaps the men don't necessarily go through? What was the thought process behind that?
So 2 points here. Mm-hmm. The first one was, the community leader did specifically highlight that there were women in that community that were looking for opportunities. So that very easily helped us narrow down what our target audience was going to be in that community. But secondly, exactly like you said, just because they're refugee doesn't mean that they are they don't face the same issues as any regular Malaysian woman might feel. Just that the circumstances are going to be a bit more different. But women and men, even within the refugee communities, face very different obstacles between each other. So obviously the focus, if you want to make a dent, this is what I believe, if you want to make a dent to any community that you aim to help, you cannot do so in a generalized way. One of the things that we spoke about was asking them what they needed. If you have a group that is far too varied, whether in terms of gender, age, socioeconomic background, how are you going to understand what it is they really need? How are you going to implement any effective initiative that's going to actually drastically change their life? So focusing on women and being very specific about our demographic was one way that we could at least ensure what we were doing was really catering to somebody's actual needs and not just our perceived idea of what change should look like within a community we want to help. So I think that really helped us kind of structure the way we're running things as well when it came to the community we wanted to serve. And in this case, it was refugee women.
Yeah. It's also low-key that we believe that women make better leaders.
I mean, I believe women make better leaders too. So, I mean, I'm still waiting for Malaysia's first women prime minister and all that. So, exactly.
We were close at one point.
100% in the same boat as y'all. But yeah. Arisa, last year in a couple of interviews, you mentioned something interesting, and that was that it was essential for y'all to not pitch the idea of Women for Refugee as a charity. Why so?
I'm going to quote something that Dav mentioned also in a few interviews last year, and that has stuck to me since. It's because we will buy into the community as much as they buy into us. And that means that we treat them as our stakeholders. we will work with them to carry out programs. We're not going to work independently without them, because it's about their community. And one thing that WFR would love to get on in the future is to maybe establish some program in leadership, because we understand that for a community, a refugee community, to sustain itself properly, they would need to be led by their own.
I just want to add something to that, and this is based on an actual discussion I was having earlier today about being in the NGO sector and then kind of looking at empowerment. Sometimes I do feel like we need to be a little bit careful with the word empowerment as well, and how we're actually defining it, because sometimes we're assuming that the people or the communities that we are talking about don't have agency. And there's such a thing as like the messiah complex, right? Where you come in thinking you are the savior to these sort of things. But the thing is, within these communities, there's already a lot of intelligence. There's a lot of capability that's already innate. And all they need is honestly just to provide them with opportunities. So I think when we say things like we don't want to come in and treat them like charity cases, we want to buy into them, it's because we see the value in these women. It's not something we are giving them. They've inherently always had it. All we are doing is basically acting as a body, a channel that they can execute through. And we're very focused and we're very intentional about this and the way we speak to them and the way we communicate that even to the general public. Because I think that's a message that honestly needs to be put out a lot more, that we are not the saviors, we are not the solution, we are merely a body.
And Arisa, has the community that WFR has been engaging with, has that grown as more and more people start knowing about WFR?
Recently, actually, we started to venture out into the neighbouring community. It was a very big risk, and me and Dav we've always talked about venturing out into the new community. But with going out into a new community, it comes with, you know, a whole process of gaining their trust. So it's definitely not easy, and we don't take it lightly as well. But recently, right now, thank God, we're slowly trying to connect with the neighboring community. Our current database is actually about almost 200 families of Myanmar Muslims, Rohingyans, Malaysians, and Indonesians. And it's so important for WFR to hold that database, so that when NGOs want to come in and so-called help, they have to go through WFR, because WFR knows what these people need, or WFR knows how these people work, or WFR knows how to manage these people without frustrating that NGO. We need your resources, sure, but there needs to be an ethical way of coming in and providing service. And that's how WFR has expanded its reach into the community itself. I mean, one day it'd be great to see the whole of Selayang under WFR with like 10 million women leaders.
That would be great.
That would be amazing.
Maybe, yeah. you know, y'all just started. It's only been a few months. Who knows where the journey will take y'all?
We've honestly talked about like a little headquarters where we would have like completely run by the refugee women. So there'd be like a little cafe, they'll have your office area. It's our long-term plan.
That is super, super cool. Before we wrap up this conversation, ladies, let me know, tell me what... Because in Malaysia, you see this across many countries, right? But especially in Malaysia, especially when things get a little tough, you know, like the COVID-19 pandemic, immediately the narrative, you know, is easily just switched around to let's blame the refugee community. They are bringing the virus. Let's, they are here to steal our jobs. This you hear this all the time, you know, the level of xenophobia that many Malaysians have towards migrants and refugees. What message would you give to Malaysians, Davina?
Okay, where do I start with this one? I think I've thought about this quite a lot, to be honest, especially the more and more we've gotten involved in the refugee sector. And I realized multiple things. I think the first is that I don't blame the worry that can come to most Malaysians, because like I've said, I think I've mentioned this in other conversations or interviews as well. it is hard to want to recognize the rights of somebody who is foreign to you when you yourself feel like a second-class citizen in this country. And that is a reality that we have to be honest about. But I think that important for us to realize as Malaysians is that these are a community of people that are already here. So when we are not tackling the issues, we are not only closing a blind eye, we are amplifying long-term effects to their community and our own communities. So I think it's important for us to take into account, right, that this is a problem that's already here. How do we identify that how we can solve this problem or how we can play a part in it that is beneficial to them but also beneficial to us? Hence why in WFR we talk a lot about the economic effects of recognizing their rights. Because I think that is something that is very beneficial to Malaysians. I can sit down and talk to you about the human rights aspect of why we need to recognize these rights. But I don't think we're not arguing about the human rights aspect of things anymore. We're talking about prosperity. We're talking about safety. I think most of the time, this is the argument I see from locals. This is what they're worried about. And I think they're valid concerns. So how do we identify and address those concerns so that they don't have to be fearful of someone they don't know, of communities they don't know, communities that are foreign to them? And I think something I realized today is that sometimes we look at refugees like they are foreigners, they're different from us.
Right.
But even in a religious context, right, they are elements of people leaving one place for another. This whole concept of being a refugee, fleeing one place, going to another, is something that has been around for decades, years, and it's
even that's essentially how societies are formed.
Exactly. This is not new. This is not something that happened over the last like 10 years. This is something that even in our scriptures we've kind of read about and seen. So I think we need to stop alienating this concept and understanding that it is something that happens. So how do we get comfortable with the fact that this is not going to stop anytime soon? Because you can't ensure wars won't happen. You can't ensure genocides won't happen, but you can ensure that you have the policies and the structures to be able to handle it, and in a way that is protective of your actual community, not your actual, of natives in this country, of actual Malaysians as well. So yeah, that's how I look at it.
Arisa?
The whole blame game situation is so popular with the narrative that we have right now. And like I said before, like the topics of race and religion is the easiest thing to politicize if you're in Malaysia, right? So that's why it's been so easy for any one of us to swallow a narrative given by a politician about the refugees taking our jobs, because it's something that we've constantly heard within the same conversation of race and religion. I think with all the accusations about refugees taking jobs and all of this and all of that, it's I can't invalidate someone else's feelings. You know, like Dav said, they are feeling like a second class citizen, and the agendas that they may have against the refugee community may have been politicized to an extent. All we can do is to create that awareness, and it goes back to providing the same education that people like us have. I mean, even in the NGO sector, actually, there are a lot of racist, biased people who work in the NGO sector who just rant their mouths about things that shouldn't be talked about. You know, so what sector are you, even in that sector, it's problematic. So how exactly are you going to change people's minds about a foreigner? If you go anywhere in the country, that the whole perception of refugees is very common. You know, that's the reality that we're dealing with. But I don't know. I mean, when I usually do have conversations like this, I usually just talk to them directly. I think what I recently posted a conversation I had with a Grab driver. He was talking about how they're taking local jobs, and I'm like, how? You just have to ask the question. You don't attack him, but you just say, okay, how? Okay, but did you know? Okay, so to facilitate those kind of conversations where everyone is heard is so important, especially in things like that are so sensitive like this, the refugee crisis.
Well, on that very, very important note, ladies, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
That was Davina Devarajan and Arisa Jemima Ikram, the co-founders of Women for Refugees, an initiative which aims to empower illiterate migrant and refugee women to integrate into local communities. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous episodes of Good Things, you can download the podcast on the BFM app. You just have to search for Good Things. You can also check us out on BFM.my. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Good Things on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.